Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disabilities who have taken from them or are denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those above them. In 2004, we met dub poet Clyde Brooks, and we had a talk about oppression and disability, and Clyde offered to come into the show and talk to us, sat down and said, "Are you going to do an interview?" And I said, "An interview? I thought we were going to talk about involvement in the show." Well, here's the result.
You saw some interesting connections between the place of disabled people in our culture and the issues that you raised with dub poetry.
Yeah. Well, the whole quest, like, for example, the name of your show, mm-hmm. it's about disrespect. Mm-hmm. Respect and disrespect, they are very salient themes in Caribbean literature, certainly, and by extension in Black American literature and Black British literature. And I think increasingly in general youth culture, in hip-hop culture too, the whole notion of disrespect and respect is very powerful. And I think that's a response to the fact that individual rights have been increasingly marginalized by notions of globalization, of corporate restructuring, and all those buzzwords and the jargon that they tell us, this is the reason why we have to disrespect you. So we can balance the books. And the disabled who have already been dissed just by that label that has been put on them. Like, it is not really a disablement. It is a sort of physical difference that you were probably born with or come about through accident. You, a lot of times, through no fault of your own. And why should you suffer for it?
I just wanted to recall that disrespect explores stigma and not functional limitation is what makes a person, quote, disabled, unquote, in moral and political terms.
Yes.
That's the theme of the show.
You see?
So we examine not people's limitations, but we examine the stigma that they deal with and how it affects them and hopefully how they overcome it.
Stigmatization has been attached to a number of us, like Blacks, for example. I believe you have to be a person first before you can be Black, you can be disabled, you can be white, you can be male, female, rich or poor. If you're not a person, then none of that arises. So I say take it back to the person and deal with each person. And my personal mission is to attempt to make changes one person at a time. If I can change just one person each time, I think I have done something.
I think you have too. Well, tell us about your start. My listeners haven't heard about it, your start in teaching. And it's very dedicated. It's very interesting.
Well, the first job I had after I left school at 19 was as a teacher, pre-trained teacher. Then I did that for 2 years, decided I wanted to be a teacher. Then I went to teachers' college, but got caught up in the poetry which was happening at the time. Dub poetry was just coming to the forefront in Jamaica.
What years?
1976 to 78. There was a lot of political upheaval going on.
Post-independence.
Right, and the flirtation with socialist and communist doctrine, the Michael Manley Peer Trudeau era. It was quite an exciting time and quite a destabilizing time for a young person I was sort of hailed as, you know, promising poet. I was doing great performances, I thought, at the time. People said I'd be famous in 5 years. So what the hell, I dropped out of college to pursue a poetry career. I'm still pursuing it avidly. I haven't caught up with it yet, but I think I'm closing the gap a bit.
Right. You spent some time in the Hills.
After I dropped out, finished with teaching, I thought, I'm going to be a poet. I went to the Hills to sort of get grounded in earth and sky and animals, birds, you know, to kind of communicate with myself. And I saw a lot of kids, older teenagers in those mountain villages who couldn't read but who were very talented and who had great turns of phrases in the Jamaican dialect. And I thought, wow, how could I tap into this to teach them to read? So we went through poetry and we did drama, whereby we would just do the plays or the poems on a tape recorder. And then they would start learning to read and write by reading or writing their own words that they had created and memorizing them. And we would use the dialect as a base to translate it into English, and they would see the relationship between the language that they used and the language which was a standard in school. And we had some very notable successes. People went on to schools. We produced a teacher or two, a few policemen, soldiers, what have you. And I caught the attention of the Jamaican Ministry of Culture, and they got me working as a cultural officer, so my life took another turn there.
How did you end up performing for us?
I ended up in Canada, I think, by a true providential design. It seemed like an accident at the time. I was doing fine in Jamaica. I had a budding career as a poet. Some respect within the establishment. I was a well-recognized teacher. I was traveling a bit, and then my wife's family migrated to Canada, and her family is very closely knit, so she started pining after the extended family. And I said, okay, go ahead. She came to Canada. I said, okay, I'll be the long-distance husband. It's not too bad. Being married but not having to, you know, listen to the wife. And then I came here for the Dub Poetry, first International Dub Poetry Festival in 1993. And my wife said, okay, you're here. You either stay or, well, you go away. So I'm here. It's as simple as that.
Very good. I heard you at the staircase the other night. You have an ongoing fountain of interest in political expression behind your work, which doesn't stop. What are you working on now?
Oh, I'm working on this notion of social and environmental deficit within capitalism. I have long come to the conclusion that capitalism really is the only viable economic system that we have left for the moment. So we really can't resist it anymore. We have to try and see how we can improve it. And one way to improve capitalism is to embrace these two notions, that there are environmental deficits and social deficits incurred through corporate action or government action. And fiscal deficit is not the only important thing, not because social deficit and environmental deficit does not show up in the red ink. That doesn't mean it's not there, and it's going to come back to bite us really big in the butt.
Carl Martin, are you listening?
Later on. But with crime, with psychological disorders, social unrest. It's going to cost us more later, not to mention the ecological damage that we might do, you know, with ill-advised projects. And then tomorrow, who's going to pay for it? The babies. That's not fair. So I'm trying to see how I can put that in a poem which fits in my style, which is, I think, is kind of, sort of cynical, comical, you know?
You put all this work into one poem.
Yeah, and sometimes I do research. Like, I'm also researching a poem about the fourth world, which I discovered about 2 years ago. Those are the indigenous peoples of the world who have been marginalized and disrespected and disabled, disenfranchised, just totally dissed by their respective governments. And this fourth world is not a race thing, because in Nigeria you have fourth world tribes who are being oppressed by a black government. In Central America, the same thing. We have our fourth world here in Canada. We call them
Aboriginals.
Yes, so I'm very, very serious about blending fact into my work. Because as I have said on stage, this is what I do is not an act. It's the fact between the acts. The idea of performance in general, especially in pop culture, is all about acting, putting on a show, affecting a persona, embracing the spectacle. But how I see poetry from the dub poet standpoint, which is pretty well an international viewpoint in terms of dub, is that it is an engine for social awareness, hence social change. It is a way to affect history, and it is a way to import a specific discursive platform into a given context. So it's not about acting, it's not really about performing in the sense of sham.
So the context is the issue. The discursive platform is dub poetry.
Right. And the action is performance.
Right.
It is not acting, it's action. Yeah.
I know we discussed it before the interview, but you asked if I knew Paul who?
Paul Afrere. He wrote a very interesting book in the 70s. More than interesting, it was like a seminal work that guided a lot of community activists, Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And his idea was that the word should be a speech act, that the word, it's not only great just to have nice fancy phrases, you know, or enlightening comments, but you have to put your words into action. So I sort of took that and ran with it in terms of the poetry.
Poetry and performance?
Yeah. The poem being an actual piece to perform, a dramatic or musical piece, and B, the poet being responsible somehow to his poetry, especially if it is politically oriented and sort of progressive or leaning towards consciousness or whatever, then one has some duty to try and measure up to some extent to all those lofty ideas that you're portraying on stage.
Measure up in what way?
In terms of your personal self. In, for example, if I go out there and speak about togetherness, world unity, a sense of earthiness of us all being one race, the human race, then I think I should try and portray that to a large extent in my personal life. Right now, for example, I'm struggling with the issue of masculinity and sexism. I was raised as a sexist. Literally, I went to an all-boys school, which is one of the places where they train you to be sexist in order to propagate that sort of a male-dominant system, you know? And even though my wife would tell you that I am not fully rehabilitated, but I'm working on it. At least I accept, you know, the distance I have to go and where I must head for.
He's here, he's real, but ladies, he's married.
Coming up,
James Carter leading the hauler Poe Lazarus, recorded by the Coen brothers for their movie, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, when James Carter was actually on a chain gang. James Carter died November 26th.
Here's the limb on the commissary garret. Well, they take them pull out of the then they laid him on the commissary garret. He said, my wounded side, Lord, Lord, my wounded side.
I had never imagined so much investment could go into such a finely tuned product.
Yeah. Well, dub poetry arose generally out of the need in post-colonial societies, especially in Britain and the Caribbean, to address a sense of literature which did not incorporate the indigenous voice as a valid muse. A Jamaican voice, which is rooted in the Jamaican treatment of English, rooted in Jamaican experiences, and seen through the eyes of Jamaicans looking at the world. Not Jamaicans trying to sound like how they think the world wants them to sound.
Gotcha.
And so dub was, in that sense, very revolutionary. And was a sort of departure from literature, it seemed. But later on, after I researched it, I realized that it was not a departure, but it was a return to the roots of poetry, which were necessarily oral. Because, of course, we could speak before we could write. So poetry began as an oral art form. And because I think of the dominance of print, it became like page bound. And when it began to resurge as an oral art form, again because of improvements in technology, multimedia especially, we have come back to the oral state of expression, but on an electronic level, in dub poetry especially, we call it 3D poetry. And body is very important.
So you're saying it will be incorporated with
video? Right, yeah, right, because video enhances the audience's ability to access certain levels of the poetry that they could not become aware of on the page. Like, when you see the poet on stage, it's very different from seeing the poem on the page. And in dub poetry is what I call a very idiocentric form of poetry, in that each poet brings his or her own personality into the poem. So when you experience, say, for example, a Clyde Brooks performing, you're getting the personality of the poet as opposed to a Mota Baruch or a Okwunor or a Cherry Natural or a Jean Breeze or Canada's Queen of Dub, Lillian Allen. You know, each person brings that special something that makes it different, makes it not generic. And so you cannot see one dub poet and say, oh, I've seen dub. Because it's so wide. It's so idiosyncratic.
And nor can you read it and say, I've seen dub.
No, if you've read it, you've just... It's reading dub poetry only is like buying a house and only looking at the picture. you could never get that... 3D experience that you get from the walk to the open house.
That's true.
You're right. People have their day job and they do poetry on the side as some sort of personal therapy or what have you. But dub poets see poetry as a craft, like masonry or carpentry. It's work. The poet is a craftsperson. And so we need to be paid. And I think, because we're moving closer towards the requirements of pop culture. For example, you can throw a dub poet into a rock concert and dub poet will do very well. So it's up to us now to use like culture jamming strategies to get into that kind of mainstream thing. When I come from a poetry reading, my kids ask me, how much did you make from that poetry reading, Dad? Right. You know? Yeah. And I think dub poetry especially can be marketed without being contaminated. It's like currency, unrecognized currency. We have to put it on the market and say, hey, you can trade in this currency.
Very good. We were going to tell our listeners about your next episode, Clyde. You're at the Staircase on Friday, December the 19th at 8 p.m.
Yeah, doing poem magic. And we try to make it really magical. I bring the poems, you bring the magic. Each person who comes to Poem Magic is a special person. Just by making the choice to come there. I like the direction you're taking the show in. Really, it's all one struggle. There's one huge umbrella of this enfranchisement, disrespect that the system is trying to spread over all of us, ordinary folks. And we have to join hands across all lands, across all fences, visible and invisible, and resist it and say, no, we refuse to be dissed. Don't disrespect us.
If you do come on the show, it's not required. Copies of your interview are available if you bring your own CD. We'll send you back a copy with your interview on it for your own personal listening for Collect Courier. Disrespect acknowledges help from the host of Come Sunday. Music from Gospel's Golden Age and Beyond, Fridays 1 p.m. to 1:30. And now we'd like to bring you Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These are not the stories that we read to you from the paper. These are abbreviations of those stories from the papers that we specify in the broadcast. Toronto Star, Friday, July 16th. Group files 5 complaints about policing at the G20. Civil Liberties Association alleges police violated charter rights and contravened criminal code. The Canadian Civil Liberties Association submitted their complaints to the Office of the Independent Police Review Director, an arm's-length agency that investigates public complaints against Ontario's police services. The complaints relate to 5 police actions during the summer weekend. Policing of demonstrators at Queen's Park on June 26, shortly after the eruption of violence caused by demonstrators using black bloc tactics. Policing on the Esplanade, June 26, when officers detained and arrested hundreds of protesters outside the Novotel Hotel. Detentions and arrests of protesters outside the Eastern Avenue Detention Center on June 27. Detentions and arrests at the intersection of Queen Street West and Spadina Avenue on June 27th, and conditions inside the Eastern Avenue Detention Center. Said Kara Zweibel, a lawyer with the CCLA, they relate to what we saw as the biggest abuses of power during the G20. She said all complaints are directed at the summit's RCMP-led Integrated Security Unit and the Ontario Provincial Police. Globe and Mail, Thursday, July 15th. Groups criticize use of bank software to identify G20 suspects. Courts lack experience with facial recognition technology, civil liberties groups warn. By John Lorink and Jill Mahoney. Civil liberties groups are condemning as a legal black hole the Toronto Police Service's plan to use the banking industry's facial recognition software to help identify people on a G20 most wanted list. At a news conference Wednesday, Detective Sergeant Gary Giroux released the photos of 10 suspects and said the force intends to work with the Canadian Bankers Association, which owns the software. The concern of Canadian Civil Liberties Association is that the lack of experience of the judicial system with facial recognition software and the danger of many people being arrested based on a technology that has not been fully explored and tested in our legal system, said CCLA General Counsel Natalie DeRosier. Detective Sergeant Giroux said police haven't yet used the facial recognition software because he's still determining whether it is acceptable for a Canadian Banking Association technician to work with police databases. It's more of a logistical issue as to whether or not members of the banking community can tap into our system. The investigation use of technology is in its infancy. The American Civil Liberties Union, citing various U.S. government studies, has warned that facial recognition software can be inconsistent because individuals' facial features, unlike iris patterns or fingerprints, can change quite rapidly. The concern, said Ms. DeRosier, is the lack of certainty. The approach could also raise privacy issues as the police surveillance data would be made available to a private entity. Again, Globe and Mail, Wednesday, July 14th. Human rights. Cancer patient wins discrimination suit. Former employers ordered to pay $20,000 undergo human rights training. By Anne Hui. 6 months after discovering she had breast cancer and 5 months after being fired for it, Elsa Torrejon is still fighting. She's already won a $20,000 judgment against her former employer in a case that highlights the plight of those who fall ill while working for small companies. Now the 52-year-old single mother of two is ready to hear she's cancer-free as well. My mind is that the tests will be clear, she said of the CT scan and ultrasound results she expects. I want to work. The Ontario Human Rights Tribunal announced Tuesday the 13th that it has awarded Ms. Torjon, who was a leasing agent at Weston Property Management for about 9 months, compensation for lost wages and emotional distress because the company discriminated against her on the basis of a disability. Her managers were also ordered to undergo training on Ontario's human rights regulations. After Ms. Torrejon was diagnosed in January, her managers, Doug and Jerry McDonald, asked her to provide written notice of when she intended to leave. So Ms. Torrejon scrawled the words, I, Elsa P. Torrejon, will be working till February 12, 2009, hastily across a piece of paper, thinking she was notifying them of an indefinite leave. But after she rescheduled her surgery, Mrs. Torrejon learned that the McDonalds had taken the note as her resignation and told her not to bother returning to work. She contacted the Human Rights Legal Support Center and brought a case against the company. The Montreal-based company manages apartment buildings in Toronto, where Mrs. Torrejon worked at a five-person office. Throughout the hearings, the McDonald's said they were unaware of their obligations under the Ontario Human Rights Code to accommodate ill employees. Her lawyer, Michelle Mulgrave, said, small company or not, employers have a duty to educate themselves. If you're going to open business in this province, there are laws you have to follow. Ms. Torrejon says she's proud of what she did. When there is something unfair, research and go fight it, she said. Be strong and fight it. And from the Globe and Mail, Paul Taylor, small doses, fish oil tied to breast cancer prevention. Research suggests that fish oil supplements may help guard against some types of breast cancer. The findings are intriguing and bound to fuel more interest in the already popular fish oil supplements, which are also thought to help curb the risk of heart disease. The study involved more than 35,000 postmenopausal women who completed a questionnaire about their use of non-vitamin, non-mineral supplements. After 6 years of follow-up, a total of 80 women were diagnosed with breast cancer. The researchers then analyzed the data to see if taking any supplements bestowed some protection against breast cancer. Only fish oil stood out. Regular use of this supplement, which contains high levels of omega-3 and other fatty acids, was linked to a 32% reduced risk of breast cancer, according to the findings published in the journal Cancer Epidemiology, Biomarkers and Prevention. But the protection applied only to invasive ductal carcinoma, the most common type of breast cancer. In theory, at least, fish oil may provide a partial shield against cancer through its anti-inflammatory properties. Said Emily White of the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center in Seattle, inflammation causes cells to divide and proliferate, and when cells divide, that provides the opportunity for genetic errors to accumulate, and that leads to cancer. So there's pretty good evidence that inflammation is involved in cancer, and fish oil may act as an anti-inflammatory drug. Meanwhile, researchers at Harvard University are launching a major clinical trial to assess omega-3. When those results are in, likely several years from now, doctors and patients will have a better idea if fish oil really can help prevent breast cancer. Winnipeg from the Globe and Mail by Patrick White. Said City Councillor Gord Steves, we hear all kinds of complaints, but by far the most vitriolic comes when the mosquito counts get high. And right now, after the wettest spring ever recorded on the prairies, that hostility is verging on violence, mainly against the 1,606 Winnipeggers who have opted out of the city's mosquito spraying program over health concerns. Under city policy, a 100-meter no-spray zone is placed around these homes, creating mosquito breeding grounds as big as city blocks. At Mr. Steve's urging, the city's taking action. It forwarded to the province a recommendation to shrink the buffer zones. Neighborhoods have been doused with the chemical malathion since 1969, the year DDT was phased out as a weapon against the city's blood-sucking hordes. Winnipeg is the only major Canadian city to conduct a large-scale spraying effort against nuisance mosquitoes. While studies have shown that malathion destroys population of insects other than mosquitoes, its long-term effects on human health are unclear. And Lindsay lives with an asthma sufferer and said he would have to go to the hospital if exposed to malathion. I know people who have to leave the city entirely when they're fogging, said Mrs. Lindsay, executive director of Manitoba Echo Network. The contentious buffer zone issue ultimately depends on the province, which licensed the use of pesticides. Conservation Minister Bill Blakey has expressed a willingness to address the issue. Said Mr. Steves, malathion is available in hardware stores. Neighbors are buying this and fogging the heck out of their yards regardless, so the buffer zones are really not achieving the end they should be. It's a situation of people cutting off the nose to spite the face. And we have a short update on a tenant facing vermin at a Fengate Properties address. We have it from a reliable source that that address is now affected not only by mice, but by roaches and bed bugs. Some tenants are in despair. We really hope that the landlord will put his house in order before the provincial and city governments who have been asked to intervene come down hard on this disrespecter of people with disabilities' quality of life. And if you don't feel you're getting your response from the city that you want, you know you have a voice at the polls coming up in October. Let's break from the news with Albert King, Born Under a Bad Sign.
1, 2. Born under a bad sign. I've been down since I began to crawl. If it wasn't for bad luck, I wouldn't have no luck at all. Hard luck and trouble is my only friend. I've been on my own ever since I was kid. Born on a bad sign. I've been down since I began to crawl. If it wasn't for bad luck, I would have no luck at all.
I can't read.
I done learned how to write. My whole life has been one big fight. Born on a bad sign. I've been down since I began to crawl. bad luck. I would have no luck at all. Yeah, I'm a bad luck boy. Been having bad luck all my days,
And by Stephen Drake from his blog, Not Dead Yet. Sunday, July 18th. The Final Exit Network, FEN, has a billboard up in New Jersey now. It's received a fair amount of coverage, and all of it has been inaccurate and superficial. Not one article has mentioned the criminal charges FEN members face in Georgia and New Jersey, let alone the fact that two FEN members in Arizona have entered into plea bargains, which include a commitment to testify against their fellow FEN members. The Arizona case involves the death of Jana Van Voorhees, a woman who had no serious physical illnesses, but a long history of emotional troubles. FEN's involvement in her death contradicts the claims being made in current coverage that the organization engages in some sort of psychological screening. The press has gone long partway with FEN's description of their opponents, people with religious motivations. But the only group that's engaged in a physical protest of FEN is Not Dead Yet, and we're a bunch of secular disability rights activists. The first red flag went up on Dr. Judith Springer's comments in her first press quotes that appeared in the Star-Ledger giving her reaction to the FEN billboard. Therapists called the billboard irresponsible, arguing it could serve as a tipping point for troubled teens or others at risk of suicide. The idea of any of these upset, impressionable kids seeing a billboard like that absolutely horrifies me, said Judith Springer, a Morristown psychologist and board member of the Society for the Prevention of Teen Suicide. You can't filter who sees a publicly displayed sign. The quote bothered me a little since there seemed to be room here that, in her opinion, there is an appropriate audience for the sign and the organization. Turns out my vague concerns were all too valid. In a July 16th article written by Fox News religion correspondent Lauren Green, Springer reiterated her previous comments and then expanded on them. Springer says she's not opposed to Final Exit Network's message, just how they're sending it. I visited the website and it's populated by elderly folks who are at the end of a very long life and are in pain, she said. That's a whole different issue to me. Let's translate. Springer has just shrugged off any concern about any group that encourages and facilitates the suicides of elderly folks because it's different than what she deals with. I thank Judith Springer. She's the first one in the suicide prevention community that I know of to be so open about this abandonment. She's to be congratulated for her honesty, even if there's not much else I can think of to congratulate or thank her for. And in international disability news, BBC News Health, 13th July 2010, making the choice between life and death. On October 23rd, 2009, Richard Rudd was riding a motorcycle when he hit a car at speed. He was found 6 meters away from his bike. After spending a month undergoing various tests and scans, it was confirmed that the paralysis of both arms and legs was to be permanent. Initially, it was believed that Richard had fallen into a coma from which he was unlikely ever to emerge. Richard was unable to respond to his family or even to doctors treating him, but then a startling discovery was made. The attending consultant, Professor David Menon, discovered that Richard was able to move his eyes in response to simple commands and questions. Professor Menon is a world-leading expert in the treatment of brain injuries, and 13 years ago he established the Neurocritical Care Unit in Addenbrooke's Hospital in Cambridge. It is now the largest unit of its kind in Europe. In this unit, the rules governing death are directly challenged. It's really important to think about death not as an event, but as a process, said Professor Menon. That process can be strung out quite considerably and slowed down. It can also be interrupted.
For example, death is commonly viewed as an event which involves cessation of the heartbeat. In actual fact, it is irreversible damage to the brain that decides whether a person survives or not, and the heart needs to have stopped for several minutes before such damage results. Around 40% of patients admitted to the unit make a meaningful recovery. 2 months after Richard's accident, a speech therapist was asking him the same 20 simple questions about his interests and family each day. He answered by moving his eyes left or right to signal yes or no responses. Richard had been in the NCCU for 6 months before Dr. Minot asked him the question he had wanted to ask him ever since he saw his eyes move for the first time. "He remembered he had had an accident," said Professor Minot. "He was aware that he was being treated on an artificial ventilator and being fed through a tube going into his stomach, and this was likely to be going on for some time. I didn't specify how long. Finally, I then asked him if he were happy for us to go on treating him. And he said yes. On 3 occasions, he made it clear, just with yes-no answers, that this was a consistent response. Richard's now able to make facial expressions, and his long-term memory is intact. He's been moved to a different unit nearer his home in Worcester, and after seeing slow but steady improvements, Richard Rudd Sr. has changed his view. If a person can't decide for themselves, sometimes you feel that you can decide for them. Because in theory you think you can never live in that situation, you sometimes put that judgment onto somebody else. At the end of the day, you probably have no right to do that. But now Richard's in the situation where that's actually happened. It's real life. It's not pretend. He is in that situation. The will to live takes over. From the Globe and Mail, Thursday, July 15th, Avandia Drugs Future, Subject of FDA Meeting, by Lisa Richwine, Gaithersburg, Maryland. U.S. health advisors weighed whether GlaxoSmithKline's diabetes pill Avandia should remain on the market, as the company was reported to have agreed to pay about $460 million U.S. to settle lawsuits alleging the drug caused heart attacks and strokes. The debate on Avandia's safety has raged since warnings were placed on the drug in 2007, saying some research shows a link with a higher heart attack risk, but the data is inconclusive. 2 U.S. senators released internal company documents that they said showed Glaxo sought to play down scientific findings about Avandia's safety as far back as 2000, shortly after the drug was approved. The FDA staff are split over Avandia's safety, and the recommendations of the advisors are expected to make its final decision in the coming months. Some FDA staff see the Glaxo drug as more dangerous to the heart than Takeda Pharmaceutical Company's rival diabetes pill, Actos, with no unique benefits. Toronto Star, Carol Gore, Friday, July 16, 2010. Overstretched charities turning away clients. A survey of 311 charities and voluntary organizations conducted this spring by the Social Planning Network of Ontario showed that demand for services, everything from food assistance to suicide counseling, is still rising while donations dwindle. A first report entitled Hard Hit was released in November 2009. It showed that roughly half of the province's nonprofit social agencies were unable to meet the needs of those who sought help. The 2010 update, a recovery-free zone, showed that despite working longer hours, using more volunteers, and redoubling their funding efforts, 50% still had to turn away clients. But the clients were needier. In the early days of the recession, people sought help because they'd been laid off or denied benefits. By 2010, they were coming in with a snarl of problems. They couldn't find work. They'd exhausted their employment insurance. They couldn't pay their bills. They were being threatened with eviction, and their health was deteriorating. Through the lean times, nonprofit agencies have done everything they can to insulate their clients from their financial woes, but an increasing number have had to suspend programs or close their doors. There are a couple of glimmers of hope in the 2010 report. Some foundations are recovering from last year's plunge in the value of their endowments. They may resume grant-making later this year or in 2011. The Ontario government announced last April that it was launching a long-term strategic plan to strengthen its partnership with the nonprofit sector. Government funding to nonprofit agencies started to fall this year. The Social Planning Network expects sharper declines as political leaders shift from stimulus to austerity. Another worrisome indicator, half the agencies in the survey expected to emerge from the economic downturn irreversibly damaged. The network made exactly the same recommendations this year as in 2009. It called for a stimulus fund to promote nonprofit work, an expansion of employment insurance, and a commitment not to cut the deficit on the backs of the vulnerable. Madeleine Meyer ignored its proposals last year. All the signs suggest they'll encounter the same fate this year. The recession tracking project, as a call to action, lacks ideas with the power to mobilize communities and move politicians. And in good news this week, from the Toronto Star, at Wychwood Barns, a global garden grows. You can find the vegetables and herbs of Somalia, the Philippines, China, South Asia, Latin America, Italy, and Poland, all here on seven small plots of land at the Artscape Wychwood Barns on Christie Street near St. Clair Avenue. And in each garden are senior citizens, immigrants from those seven regions of the world, armed with watering cans and hand cultivators, seedlings and seeds, puttering thoughtfully through the greenery. This is the first growing season for the Global Roots Garden at the Stops Green Barn. Seniors are in charge of the gardens. Young recruits will do the grunt work, and they will share their wares amongst themselves after harvest, also giving some to the Stop Community Food Center, which runs a food bank and community bake ovens. 76-year-old Christina Hinlo says, in the Philippines, there were gardens at school. Each class had a different plot where students would grow vegetables. She also raised plants at home growing up. But Hinlo says, we don't have a garden here in Canada because we have an apartment. Many of the seniors here are in similar situations. They don't garden in Canada because they don't have a yard to garden in. Hania Miernik, 59, moved to Canada from Poland 18 years ago as a live-in nanny and housekeeper. She now lives alone in an apartment and says programs like this one help get people out of their homes and brighten their spirits. Some people are very down, and when they're coming for this program, they're up, she says. That's all the news on Disrespect this week. Come back next week. There will be more. To take us out, Albert King, I Worked Hard.
I work hard today, and I'm tired of the mess and me. I'm not too tired for some of your loving, the love you got pleasing me. Oh, I never can tell what you got, you wear is that. And I love the way you rub my back. I work on a construction job. I work long hours every day. Oh, my head is aching when I get home. I want you loving it anyway. Oh, you know how to soothe the pain, and that's a fact. Girl, I love the way you rub my back. pain every night. Hey, you're 96 pounds, baby. You're 96 pounds of dynamite. After I play with the kids, I'm ready to relax. You can put the kids to bed and come and rub my back.
If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited from live telephone and studio interviews.